Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Kevin Harris, a comparative historical sociologist and the associate director of Princeton University's Mosavar Rahmani Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies. His research focuses on political economy, welfare systems, economic history, and social movements in Western Asia and Northern Africa. And he is currently completing a book project that concentrates on post-revolutionary Iranian state and society, which will be the topic for today. Professor Harris has written a number of research articles as well as pieces for the general populace that we will link to on our website, so please be sure to visit. Kevin, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start off our interview today by noting that it is Wednesday, June 18th, 2014. The nature of our topic will have a significant historical content to it, but there may be times we touch upon current events in the Middle East region, which as of today, June 18th, seem remarkably fluid. Iran appears to be getting involved in the sectarian civil war in Iraq, which seems to be connected to the sectarian civil war in Syria, which seems to have some origins in the region-wide protests collectively known as the Arab Spring, and on and on. So it would appear that the foot bone is connected to the ankle bone, which is connected to the leg bone, etc., etc. But our main subject for the conversation today will be Iran, its Islamic Revolution back in 1979, and more importantly, events that have transpired since then, which will help us get a handle on contemporary events, if I am not mistaken. So let's get down to that. You ready, Kevin?
Sure.
All right, let's start out in the contemporary world, and then we'll slingshot back about 35 years. Our listeners are probably very interested in the current goings-on in the Middle East. How big of a factor has Iran's Islamic Revolution and its subsequent Shiite government been on what has been transpiring in the region in the past year or so? Does Iran cast a pretty big shadow there?
Well, we should probably look at what the short-term effects of the 1979 revolution were in terms of exporting the so-called revolution, as it used to be called, and then what were the actual effects over the long term. And in that sense, there was, of course, a revolution in Iran in 1979, one of the big world historical popular revolutions of the 20th century. And one segment of the political elite that sort of created the Islamic Republic were very into the concept of exporting the revolution, exporting this idea of an Islamic revolution you could take around the Middle East and just sort of implement it, and everybody would be inspired to do this. And there was a brief period for the first year, 79 to 80, when a lot of states were worried about this exporting of the revolution. But just like, let's say, the Soviet Union itself, it encountered a set of problems and it decided to export the revolution, meaning that it didn't turn out that a lot of countries were going to go the way that the sort of Bolsheviks thought they were going to go. And so they developed a concept of socialism in one country. Well, Iran is a case of political Islam in one country. They probably generally stopped, even arguably by the mid-80s, if not the late 80s, after the end of the Iran-Iraq War, of, sort of exporting the revolution and then sort of the ways that we think about it. Instead, they concentrated much more on regional affairs. Different parts of the Islamic Republic think that means different things, but it's not always been about political Islam. And so one of the sort of forgotten moments of Iranian realpolitik is right after the end of the Cold War and the Iran-Iraq War, when the breakdown of the Soviet Union caused all sorts of crises in the region, in Central Asia, for example. And Iran took a rather pragmatic position on things like the Tajikistan Civil War or the Armenian-Azeri border conflict. In fact, were very sort of neutral in that. So that doesn't necessarily mean that Islam or a particular branch of Islam or sect drives a political model. Instead, it's usually the opposite. And so ever since, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, all the way up to today, all the way up to the current conflict, internal political conflict in Iran, there have been generally two foreign policy schools of thought. One has been that the best offense is defense, and that, you know, Iran has a natural territorial sphere of influence, which is essentially, you know, the old borders of, you picked what Persian Empire you want to pick, except for maybe the really big ones in the ancient times. That we're talking about, you know, sort of the Caspian, talking about Afghanistan and a bit of Iraq, especially the Shia shrine sites, and the Persian Gulf. This is sort of Iran's natural sphere of influence, and so they should have, you know, that's where they should concentrate their efforts on in terms of, you know, sort of political influence and representation. The other side is, it is sort of linked to the other aspiration of the revolution, the idea that, you know, Iran should be a leader elsewhere in the region, and not just the region, but the world. And so their idea is that, you know, the best defense is offense. And so that side of things, generally, like they like to take it to the Levant, and, you know, sort of Iran's involvement in the Lebanese Civil War in the early 80s is related to this, not only, but that. So those two schools have been essentially not only debating, but sort of switching power every few years in Iran. But currently, the current president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, and his allies are in that, in the first school of affairs approach, and they have been since the early 90s. That's, I mean, Rouhani has been saying since the early 90s, he used to be involved with the think tank in Iran, that, you know, we have a sphere of influence related to Iran as a nation state, and that's where we should focus on. And as far as I can tell, all the foreign policy decisions that he's made since taking office about a year ago have been sort of following that line of thought.
And that's a really interesting qualifier, especially for those of us who are listening in the West, or, you know, the United States more specifically, is that when we look at foreign countries, we oftentimes primarily think of their foreign policy as it relates to us or other Western nations. And so we see the country of Iran through that lens, through its foreign policy. But as you noted, when it comes down to it, you know, the ideological fervor of the early revolution oftentimes gives way to very extant goals of trying to make the trains run on time and the sewers work right, et cetera, et cetera. So domestic politics oftentimes can trump these foreign policy concerns, even though we don't necessarily see that.
Yeah, the foreign policy decisions that we hear about in the United States are ones that, that either affect us or we think affect us. But actually, you know, Iran shares borders, both land and water borders, with, I think, near 10 countries. So they have essentially, you know, in a way, you know, and of course it's not a popular thing to say, but many of the, you know, decisions that that they've taken vis-a-vis, let's say, the Caspian Sea littoral states, or towards Afghanistan, or even towards some of the states in the Gulf, you know, that's what the policy was in the 60s and 70s as well. There have been some things, of course, that have changed, but, you know, there is the idea, and this is actually an idea that's been well discussed by the political elite in Iran, that there is this, you know, continuity in, you know, the Iranian in the Iranian polity. Part of it, this is, of course, classical nationalism. This, these guys, you know, nationalism in Iran is the underlying glue which unites even the sort of most heated disagreements between the elite, between the state and opposition movements. But underneath all this is the nationalist glue of Iran as this idea, something that supposedly goes back very far, that, you know, has this supposedly common history that that leads all the way up to today. You know, it's something that every political elite who had all even touched anywhere close to what is today Iran drew from and utilized to craft, you know, usually a pretty successful state in the medieval and early modern period. They lasted, you know, a few centuries each of them. So in that sense, they are really, you know, they don't start from scratch. As much as the idea of a revolution comes up with a, you know, is accompanied with the idea of year zero, that, you know, we're starting from scratch, we're building it all ourselves, nothing came previously. That, of course, is good for early mobilization, and every revolution produces this type of discourse. But, you know, not even by the end of the Iran-Iraq War, the Islamic Republic's elite were already borrowing from and using not just Shia symbolism and, you know, the idea of, you know, martyrs for the cause, which cause in this case, the cause of the nation-state or the cause of religion, but also drawing from old-school Iranian nationalism, you know, so the idea of the territory, the idea of the sort of people, and, you know, Iran is a multi-ethnic country. It's not a homogenous country by any means. So, you know, about one-third of the country is Turk, there's Kurds there, there's Arabs there. So the idea of, you know, Iranian-ness as this absorbing category which can, you know, take in multiple identities is something that the current political elite is very familiar with utilizing as a sort of, you know, legitimating device.
That is an important qualifier, and I completely buy into what you're saying here, is that the necessities of ruling kind of are consistent across time and space in many different places. And so even though you have a revolution, it doesn't necessarily wholesale change everything the way it is. But let's go ahead and journey back some 35 years to 1979 and explore the Iranian revolution a little bit. This is things that you talk about, and we'll talk about what has happened since then. But briefly, if you could, give us a summary of the long and short-term events that led to the 1979 revolution.
Well, there's the old adage, which is apocryphally attributed to Zhao Enlai, which is that it's too soon to tell what exactly happened in 1979. But previous to 79, there was a monarchy in Iran, just like across the Gulf, there were monarchies. And the Pahlavi monarchy, in that sense, although it attempted to link itself to this unbroken lineage of kingship in Iran, they used to have two millennium of history. In reality, it looked very much like one of these 20th century revolutions from above type nation state projects. So whether Ataturk in, you know, in Turkey, or I don't know, Vargas in Brazil, these kind of, you know, sort of top down projects to emulate either the Meijis in Japan or probably Bismarck. You know, this was the, sort of the model. So you have to sort of create a nation state out of whole cloth. In the Iranian case, you have a lot of cloth to work with. So that was a project from the, you know, early 30s to the 70s, which was a transformational project, like most 20th century states were. It reached down into parts of, you know, society which had been untouched, or at least touched in different ways by the state previously, and it brought all kinds of different people into state networks, whether education, military, economic, etc. Along the process, it created, you know, a very actually coherent state. And this is the mystery, in a way, and the thing that we still are dealing with about 1979 revolution, and that, you know, our best theory of revolution that we have today, one that actually explains pretty well, too, what happened in the Arab Spring, is that, you know, you can have mobilization of protests, right? But unless you have a true state breakdown, a division, a true structural division of elites, a fiscal crisis, things that basically make elite deadlock happen, you know, you don't get a revolution. You get a coup, you get a repression, you get civil war, but you don't get the revolution in the world historical sense. And that didn't happen in Iran. In Iran, you had no state breakdown. You had no division in the elites, the very narrow elites surrounding the Shah, the monarch. There wasn't even much of an agreement by an opposition. There was no opposition out there in formation. And even the army, which was not as neutral as people later thought. In fact, the army, you know, was very, had no problem shooting in the crowds for most of the revolution. So in that sense, the 1979 revolution, which was, you know, started, if you want to, really started in very late 77, but didn't register on anybody's radar until the second half of 1978. In fact, there's no English language newspaper that even covered the first half of 78 in Iran, the sort of protests that were happening. So in that sense, we tend to compress revolutions into an event. That revolution happened. But, you know, I don't know if anybody who's listening has ever taken part in a revolution or who was in maybe some Arab Spring protests or was in any other kind of social movement. But they're really day-to-day affairs. And the most recent sort of scholarship on the Iranian Revolution has tried to bring that back, to bring back the sort of lived experience of what it was like, because you didn't actually know what was going to happen the next day. There wasn't an outcome that you were looking at and working towards. What we do know about 1978 and 79 is that it involved a popular mobilization at least an order of magnitude higher than almost any other revolution in the 20th century, not to mention the French Revolution, where most people didn't even speak French yet, or the Russian Revolution, which, you know, mostly was happening outside of the peasantry. So if we just include the urban participants of the Iranian Revolution from all the different cities in Iran, you know, we're at least at 10% of the population, if not higher. That's higher than the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe. So it was in that sense, it was world historical. It was also a massively mobilizing event. And in that sense, it didn't start with an idea. It was a revolution that was formed out of a process. And I think the best work on the revolution, which has been written and I think now is being written again, rewriting the history of the revolution, is taking into account this process-based understanding of how the revolution came to be.
And I like this because I'm a nuts and bolts kind of guy. We have all these structural theories of state breakdown or long-term historical processes of modernization, et cetera, in the social sciences. But these things are lived out, as you say, in a day-to-day experiences of individuals, and they have to make choices on the ground that are going to go one way or going to go the other way. So it's really neat seeing how this is occurring here. And I think understanding what is going on in 78 and 79 is going to give us a little bit of insight to what happens a couple decades later in 2009 in the so-called Green Revolution, which doesn't quite mobilize as effectively. One of the questions I have for you, and this is because we are research on religion, is what role did religious organization and or religious ideology play in this day-to-day grassroots mobilization?
Right. It's I think the very first, let's say, the first theory that social scientists came up with to explain not only the revolution itself, but the base, the social base of the Islamic Republic, which was established afterwards, was this idea that the revolution came out of an alliance between the bazaar, sort of merchant capital, and the mosque, meaning sort of Shiite religious networks and their particular type of liberation theology, which had been, you know, sort of invented or reinvented in the 1960s and 1970s. I think people who think of Shiism as a sort of highly political set of theological doctrines would probably be surprised if they look at most of Iranian history or Shia history. In fact, Khomeini, you know, hated the traditional Shia clergy in Iran. He thought that they were backwards, that they were basically off in the seminaries, just, you know, working on things that not speak to everyday problems. And he, of course, he was one of them, but when he was in exile in the 60s and 70s, he, you know, this is the benefit of being an exile intellectual, he was approached by all kinds of different networks when he was living in Iraq, and then eventually was in Paris for a few months, including by, you know, the equivalent of the Iranian New Left, not to mention the Old Left. And he, you know, his language talking about religion changes in the 60s and 70s. And he really starts to sound like, you know, like Frantz Fanon by the early 70s. And some of the sort of language that he's using, he's even changing the words that he's using, talking about oppression and colonialism and imperialism. You know, the clerics didn't need to talk like this. So he didn't come up with all this himself. He really was in the middle of this very fascinating milieu, which I think most scholars associate with the year 1968, sort of the Soissons Houtard kind of movement that was going on globally, you know, from China to France to the United States. So Khomeini is a part of this, and the, you know, the sort of the ideological, the various strands of ideology which played a role in 1979 were born out of that process, that they weren't, they didn't just exist. They readily had to be created. And so that's the lead up. But the in the revolution itself, you know, it's the mosque. But if I just establish that the mosque maybe as a set of ideas wasn't as important as it is assumed to be, that it had this ready-made set of ideas. After the revolution itself, when you know people allied with Khomeini took power, well, they actually really tried to resist some of this traditional clergy from entering into the state because they had big plans. And they really thought that this was going to be a modernizing revolution, the idea that this was going to transform everyday life. And they were wary of these old clerics. And one of the things they did was to block, you know, attempts by different clerics in different parts of Iran who all have their own sort of, you know, networks and fans from commandeering, you know, sort of parts of the state. And in a sense, they actually helped to sever some of these religious networks that had been going on and redirect them vertically vis-a-vis the state. So the irony is that the 1979 revolution, which produced this sort of state centralization, produced this sort of, you know, state which had an idea about transforming society, ended up, you know, severing the dense religious networks which existed previously, which helped to organize the opposition. Same thing happened with the Bazaar. The Bazaar was, you know, this sort of horizontal networks of merchant capital sitting in different cities that made money by, you know, import-export, carpets, et cetera, et cetera. But they were getting quite rich by the 1970s, and they helped to fund, you know, opposition movements. And after the revolution, the state starts to fight a war, so it nationalizes trade. It drives deep into these commercial networks and has to basically take them over, otherwise you can't run a war. So the first theory of the revolution, that it's a Bazaar-Mosque alliance, and that, you know, basically you have this sort of traditional capitalist class and a traditional intellectual class, that they're running the state. These are kind of hangovers from Marxist analysis, in a way. Mm-hmm. But the irony is that the state broke those both up, and you ended up with this very different kind of state and a very different kind of society as a result of the post-revolutionary process.
And I want to push us forward instead of focusing on the day-to-day things that happen, that transpire in 1979, and talk about how the regime was actually then set up. And you talk about how, you know, this traditional notion of the Bazaar Mosque alliance is not quite what we pictured. And you see these alliances or the Bazaaris and old clerics in many ways broken up. How do you, what does the initial government look like after the 1979 revolution? And I mean, how does it get set up? Who decides who's in charge, and how do you get these things known as the Revolutionary Guards and the Guardian Council?
Right. Well, this is something that since it, most revolutions, their history is written by the winners. In the case of the Iran Revolution, most of the history that we've read in the U.S. at least has been written by the losers. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, but I think we still really lack an understanding of what happened after, you know, February 79 in terms of the consolidation of the state. And my research has been a bit about this. And, you know, one thing that I know is that this popular mobilization that I talked about, this sort of huge and in a way chaotic, contradictory, but definitely forceful mobilization from below, which, you know, essentially broke open the state. It caused the fractions of the elite. It forced the military to become neutral. It did not stop February 11th, 1979, that at all levels of Iranian society, all of a sudden authority was up for grabs, and not up for grabs, but under question. From Tehran to the village, from the university to the workplace, in the house, as well as in school, and in bureaucracies. And like most revolutions, this causes a lot of chaos. Think about Egypt in 2011, essentially a year where we didn't really know who was in power. In Iran, the same thing was going on for 3 years. And we only know the story from Tehran, basically. Like, no one's really, we don't really understand what happened outside of Tehran. But from people I've talked to and from some of the things that I've read and seen, this really had a big effect on the structure of the state afterwards. So unlike, let's say, like an Ataturk or a Mubarak or a top-down, centralizing state in that sense, one of the ways that, you know, the sort of new political elite attempted to deal with this mobilization from below was just to absorb it and institutionalize it, even though it was contradictory. So you had all these, you know, sort of revolutionary militias everywhere. Okay, well, let's just throw them all together and call them the Revolutionary Guards. You had all of these people, heading back to the countryside to deliver the revolutionary message to the villagers, you know, because villagers were seen as sort of the authentic, you know, Iranian revolutionary subjects in a way. You know, a lot of people were Maoists at the time. So let's take all these different people and corral them into a rural development organization. They called it the Construction Jihad. Okay, well, this happened in every avenue of state life, and it also happened at the same time that the revolution inherited the old bureaucracy of the Pahlavi monarchy. You already had a Ministry of Agriculture. You already had a military. So Iran ended up with this parallel state where there were all kinds of institutions that overlapped, but that was the way to absorb this mobilization from below. And they're still dealing with this today. I mean, one of the great, you know, the states are supposed to centralize power and to make, you know, bureaucracies where you know where the chain of command is. And in Iran, I mean, you know, every bureaucrat can tell you that this is a work in progress. And it's, I think, still a result of that initial revolutionary push. And then later, this impulse did not go away, this impulse to sort of push from below. So in that sense, the Guardian Council, which is sort of this, it acts in a way as a Supreme Court and a House of Lords at the same time. It's this body of clerics that gets the veto. It doesn't get the veto anymore. It gets to basically present its concerns on legislation passed by the parliament. Well, that was set up in 1979 to placate the traditional clerics, who were going on and on about, you know, we shouldn't have clerics running the state unless I'm part of this. and in that sense, unlike the Russian Revolution, which produced not only a Lenin, where in that sense we would have Khomeini as a Lenin, but, you know, the Islamic Republic never produced a Stalin. Certainly a lot of people probably wouldn't have minded being one, but it never produced a single a political, ideological force which could purge the entirety of the political coalition that came out of the revolution. A lot of it was purged, but actually a lot of it remained, because there were all kinds of different institutional resources to stick around. That's a whole kind of conversation itself. But that's why we get, by the way, this continuing factionalism in Iran ever since the mid-80s, when we thought, okay, Khomeini won, now who's going to be, you know, the coming strong man? And ever since then, we've heard predictions of one, like a Bonapartist figure who is going to take power in Iran, and that will be the end of this weird experiment they have. And we've also heard a lot of predictions of the collapsing, that, you know, elite conflict produces collapse, which is the general, you know, understanding in political science, that you get uncontrollable elite conflict. Iran hasn't done either. It's continued to produce this competition at the level of elites, which means that even though it's not a formally democratic political system, but it does have enough Republican democratic elements to require these elites who are always competing back and forth, to rely on them to keep mobilizing parts of society to trump their opponents. And that's why you get surprises in Iranian politics again and again and again. Mohammad Khatami's election in 1997 was so much of a surprise that, you know, people all of a sudden had to go look up who this guy was. Same for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in 2005. And same for Hassan Rouhani in 2013. In fact, the one thing I can predict about Iranian politics is that you get surprises.
And I guess that's an easy one to do. And this is very interesting, looking inside this black box that we see from the West, as and we call Iran. The politics are in many ways very confusing. A lot of us see from the outside a very monolithic theological regime, but that's not what you're describing here. Nonetheless, there does seem to be a very different theological flavor to the state that wasn't existing prior to 1979. I think a lot of people would say, well, you know, under Pahlavi, they were modernizing, secularizing. There was blue jeans and rock music, and now you get thrown in prison if you dance to the song Happy. To what sense does religious ideology lend a legitimating factor to this regime?
It's a double-edged sword. And on the one hand, it presents, of course, a ready-made, one would think, a ready-made set of ideas in order to implement law. And in that sense, the state can say, this is the law because it's Islamic. On the other hand, the problem with Islam, as probably you've talked about on your show, is that, you know, it doesn't have a political... it's not the Catholic Church. It doesn't have a history like that. In fact, when we make arguments about why doesn't Islam have its Protestant Reformation, why now this, the analogies are actually very poor. In Shiism, the, you know, authority is not centralized under any one person, and you can have, you know, sort of particular grand ayatollahs that you choose to emulate. But the problem is that since interpretation is built into the very DNA of Islamic jurisprudence, especially in Shiism, that this presented a huge problem for a state which decided to call itself Islamic in 1979. And it's even for the people who were gung-ho revolutionaries, it presented a problem. So, for example, you know, former President Hashemi Rafsanjani, who was Parliament Speaker of the Parliament in the early 80s, you know, has this famous line where he says, you know, where in the Quran can I find anything about tax policy? Where can I find anything about running a parliament? You know, how can I find anything about this? Meaning that that the basis for which policy is to be made cannot only come from, you know, the sort of the sacred texts. So that in a sense makes the state, you know, interesting to look at what it did over time. But also because there is this notion of interpretation in Shia theology, it provided a huge resource from which to critique the state. And that critique started in 1979. Like I said, there were a lot of existing clerics who weren't happy with the way things were going, but it continued up to the present day. And some of the most famous, as it was called in Iran at the time, new religious intellectuals of the 1990s, for example, Abdul Karim Sarush, who became very well known in the 1990s, they used what would be called maybe immanent critique of theology to critique the state policy. And that's happened again and again and again. It's been a huge thorn in the side of the state. In that sense, it's not like Marxism, although Marxism has its debates. But, you know, once Stalin said, scientific socialism is this, and the way you know it's this is because I say it so, well, you know, he had it solved for a while. That never happened in Iran. In that sense, the reliance of the state as on religion as a legitimating frame has actually caused as many problems as it's solved.
And you mentioned earlier that Iran is a very multi-ethnic agglomeration, Kurds and Turks and some Arabs in there and Persians, et cetera, et cetera. Was the use of religious legitimation a way of trying to form this national identity? I mean, not even, you're telling me also that it's a way to critique the state. So I could just imagine this is an entire mess.
Yeah. So, you know, when it hovers on the distance, it looks like a very coherent thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about Iranian nationalism, or you're talking about Shia eschatology, or you're talking about, you know, whatever. When you get up close, like most nationalist myths, it's a mess, right? And in that sense, the scholarship hasn't caught up with the mess yet, because people are still fighting the revolution, in that sense, in both inside scholarship as well as politically, you know, the diaspora versus the, you know, people who live inside Iran, et cetera, opposition, the state. Nobody really wants to deconstruct the myth when it's very useful. You know, I mean, the Turks have basically gone over to post-colonial studies and they deconstruct other myths now. The South Asians, that's basically all they do. But Iran, it's fascinating. Iranian studies is still a field of study deeply bound in nationalist myths, so much so that we don't even recognize it when nationalism acts as a force. And to unpack this, when you go back and unpack let's say, mid-19th century attempts at, you know, persifying the language spoken in Iran. In fact, there was a language purification movement in the Persian Empire. At the same time, there was in the Ottoman Empire. But in fact, the romanization of the Persian alphabet was attempted by the Qajar state in the late 19th century, well before Ataturk. These kind of ideas we forget, because nationalism is partly about forgetting. But the mixture of ideas from Shiism and ideas from, let's say, so-called secular Iranian nationalism, that these are always opposed to each other in the myth. But in reality, they're deeply imbricated, and it's very difficult to unpack them unless you, you know, historicize it. So I think that the multi-ethnic side of things is one part of it, a part that is probably the third rail of Iranian politics. There's one thing that everybody agrees on in Iran, and it's that Persians are the best. So on the other hand, it's very sensitive, because some of the most famous Iranian intellectuals have been Turks and Kurds, you know, and coming from other places. So it's something that is under the surface. And the great thing about Iran is that, you know, well, I should say the great thing about Iran in the current moment is that Americans have no idea Iran is multi-ethnic. I always tell people that the only way they would know that is if Iran collapsed and had a civil war. And then you would get so-called ancient ethnic hatreds fighting each other. And then CNN would say, well, we always knew that Iran was multi-ethnic, and that's why it's having this war. But Iran has been one of the great examples of multi-ethnic state building in the 20th century. And that includes, that's not just the Pahlavi monarchy, which emphasized Persianness over everything else. I used to call it a Persianocracy in a way. But the same thing under the Islamic Republic in its own way. And I don't think that Shiism is necessarily a salve, an automatic salve to paper over or to prevent these ethnic identities from butting heads. They do all the time. All the jokes in Iran are ethnic jokes. Turks this, you know, Kurds this. They're all jokes. But it does show the amount of what I guess we call it identity work that is done all the time in Iran to, again, on an everyday life. You know, people have no problem balancing, if that's the right word, these different identities based on, you know, who they're talking to, where they're going, and where they're from.
Well, ideological legitimacy or theological legitimacy is one way of trying to bind a nation together. But as we noted before, there are some things that every state, every government needs to do. They may the trains run on time, etc. And you mentioned earlier that Rafsanjani, you know, looked in the Quran and says, hey, where's the text on how to make tax policy, or, you know, how to get the sewers running and all of those kind of things. And a lot of your research has been done focusing on how the Iranian government has stabilized and consolidated its rule by creating a fairly expansive welfare system. And this might also provide some regime legitimacy, you know, the fact that your life is going okay, and, you know, irrespective of you being a Turk or a Kurd or whatever, the trains are running on time. Boy, I like this government to do that. Tell us about your work in this rather unknown aspect of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
I became interested in this subject, in welfare policy in Iran, because so much of the explanation for why the revolution, you know, succeeded is usually because of one or two things, two explanations. One is Islam. In Islam, everybody bought into Islam, and that's why they did X, Y, Z, which I never found very useful as only an explanatory frame. The other is oil. You know, the Middle East is different because it has oil. Oil creates the ability for states to, as usually said, buy off their populations. We hear it all the time about the Arab Spring. We hear it all the time about Iran, a nation of 75 million people. And I just found this incredibly facile. I mean, we don't use dollars. Scholars generally don't use that language when describing welfare systems in other parts of the world. Politicians do, but not scholars. But on the Middle East, scholars say this all the time, that's the reason why people don't rebel, is because they're being bought off. So I went and looked at, you know, what does the welfare system in Iran look like? What's its history? And what are the actual social effects of this? Because if you really are a believer in this thesis that, you know, it's the so-called rentier state thesis, that rent through the sale of a commodity, natural resource, provides a revenue base to, you know, stave off rebellion. Well, Iran is the worst case of that theory. The two decades in which the state had the highest oil revenues, the 1970s and the 2000s, both those decades ended in huge mass rebellion. So if the rentier theory is correct, then Iran is not the place to look. So I wanted to look at Iran and look at what was going on. And in that sense, you know, what happens in the formation of welfare systems is not just stasis, but I found a lot of dynamism in the effects of social policy. So in the Iranian case, you know, after the revolution, you do get this big reach down into society by the Islamic Republic. It's reaching down into parts of Iran that the Pahlavi monarchy had barely brushed. Whether we're talking about villages, we're talking about parts of cities, new parts of cities. It's also people, of course, pushing up out of the mobilizations that I mentioned. But what happens when that linkage is created? When, let's say, you know, a village gets free health care or electricity, or when, you know, universities are expanded or opened again and then expanded. Does that mean that the person who receives that or enters into that new linkage with the state, often leaving behind another linkage from the family or from an extended family, does that mean that person is then beholden to the state to do something? Well, I looked at that. I talked to lots and lots of people in Iran about their relationship with the state vis-a-vis social welfare. And what I found, I mean, almost all the time, was that as opposed to this static social contract that we expect comes out of, you know, welfare in the Middle East, it really provides, it really gives higher expectations of social mobility, that these systems, implicit to that is a promise of social mobility, both at the nation-state level, that Iran will become great again if XYZ is done, if we modernize, and education, healthcare, you know, anti-poverty programs, those are part of the modernization process of the state. This is what the state itself says. And on the other hand, people enter into these relationships thinking that, okay, I, you know, my father was a farmer. I moved to the city. I can't have five kids anymore. I can only have two. The state is, you know, helping me out with health care on a bit. That means that I'm going to send my kids to college. Right? And so it doesn't mean that my life ends. It means that I open up horizons. And so that's basically what I found, was that we tend to look at the Middle East and Iran through the politics of oil, which doesn't, you know, it indirectly affects a lot of people, but, you know, really, there's not a lot of people who work in the oil sector, so, you know, for labor studies, it's not that interesting, and you know, it's very peripheral, you know, it's generally not in the center of the country. So what's going on in the rest of the country? So I found that if you're really trying to pick up the dynamism of social change, of the ways that the state and different parts of the society both link and D-Link, social policy turns out to be a very fascinating subject. And, you know, I really think that it's a big missed opportunity for social scientists when they dismiss welfare systems in the Middle East, which generally have actually, by the way, much more robust welfare systems than other parts of the global South, because they just had stronger states in most of the 20th century. Really missing out on a wonderful way to look at social change, both in the medium term and long term, because the irony is that, you know, we think that Iran spends all this money on the poor, and that's why the poor love the state. Well, it turns out that it's actually the opposite. The state spends far more money on the middle classes, education, health, etc. But this is a middle class that was small in 79 and has got bigger and bigger and bigger. It's the middle class that's been produced to a certain extent, or at least shaped and empowered and enlarged by this state's modernizing drive, which includes welfare as a part of that. And so you get things like 2009, the Green Movement, out of this process, that the Green Movement wasn't this group of people in a vacuum that was never linked to the state, and all of a sudden decided to fight because they wanted the end of the Islamic Republic. Actually, the Green Movement is a product of this post-revolutionary drive towards modernization, state formation, and the production of new classes, which would be the, you know, cadres of the revolutionary project. And like many revolutionary projects in the past, they tend to produce their own opposition.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk now about the Green Revolution and or Green Movement, as you call it, because we can't quite call it a revolution because it hasn't really come to fruition yet, or it may never come to fruition. We're not quite sure. My first big question here, and I'm always been puzzled about these color revolutions, whether it be the Orange Revolution or the Green Revolution. I'm sure the Scots in Scotland are having a plaid revolution or something like that. Why does it become called the Green Revolution?
Right. Green Movement. It's confusing for two other reasons. One, Green Revolution in development studies means, you know, the sort of the agricultural changes in the 1960s and 70s through, you know, sort of top-down science. Then we also have the Green Revolution, Green Movements, meaning ecological movements.
Yeah, so this wasn't a rebellion of recycling in Iran.
It was studied widely in social science. And then, of course, we have the idea of green as the color of Islam. Which is, you know, especially Shia Islam. You go to any Shia shrine, there's green all over the place, green lights. So it's confusing, and as if you have the color revolutions, which were, you know, on the minds of a lot of people in the mid-2000s. Actually, because of this constant need to, you know, utilize the more Republican elements of the Islamic Republic, meaning elections and popular mobilization, that's how the color came out of it. Every candidate in 2009 chose a color to sort of, you know, print their things in and rally behind. And it just happened that the color that year of former Prime Minister Mir Hossein Mousavi, who then was running for president in 2009, was green. The incumbent, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, wisely chose the flag of Iran, all three colors, you know, so he chose the flag, nationalism visualized. So that's how it ended up being the Green Movement, is that when the election was perceived to be fraudulent by many, many people in Iran, and this sort of spillover of the election occurred afterwards into the streets, although it was already sort of happening in the streets, the election was sort of already being mobilized in the streets previously. The perceived fraudulence of the election spilled over into this protest wave, and that became known as the Green Movement, because Mousavi became, through, again, a process of mobilization, turned into an idol of political change, far more than anybody had thought, including himself.
Now, this is interesting, because this echoes back to the earlier mobilization in 1979, so there's a constant theme of societal mobilization developing here. And the other thing that we're bringing up, too, is that there are elections. And as you noted earlier, there's always surprises in Iranian politics. And sometimes the surprises don't involve fraud. Other times they might involve fraud. But I want to stop and ask you, because this is where you actually are inserted into the events of the region. I don't think you were a primary motivator of this, but you happen to be doing research in Iran in 2009. Is that correct?
Yeah. The irony is that I went to Iran trying to explain the lack, I mean, you know, sort of stasis and social contracts through welfare systems, and I ended up in the biggest, you know, mobilization from below and protest movement in Iran since the 1979 revolution.
I have to ask what that was like as a gringo American scholar. And I assume you're from the United States. You grew up here in the United States?
I did. I have the benefit of being, maybe cursed, I don't know, benefit of being Iranian American. So that's okay. Actually how I was able to get dual citizenship when I first decided to do research.
Okay, that's very interesting.
That's the first thing, although that doesn't explain a lot, because a lot of people are dual citizens and they didn't do the crazy stuff I did.
Crazy stuff. Let's hear the crazy stuff. All of a sudden you end up in the middle of this protest. I mean, give us some good stories here. What are you thinking? Are you worried about this? I mean, this guy, it's a crazy time.
Right. I mean, I was inspired, first of all, before this ever happened to me, by a book by Craig Calhoun, Neither Gods Nor Emperors, where he was teaching in Beijing in 1989. And he just happened to be there when the Tiananmen movement broke out. And he went to the protest and he wrote an excellent book about it. And now he's the head of the LSE, president of the LSE. And I knew that book from my graduate work. So I think the general rule for sociologists, especially sociologists who claim to have an expertise on social movements, which I did at the time, is the idea of if you end up in a social movement as a sociologist, then you should do the opposite of what everyone else does, meaning you should run toward it. And you actually there's a little bit of the fact that, you know, what generally most people would not want to be involved in at all is what sociologists love to be in the middle of. And it was a fascinating experience for me. I mean, I landed in Tehran 2 days after the 2009 election. I was in Armenia for a conference. I thought, like most people, was going to go to a second round of elections, so I'll just fly in 2 days after the election, so I'll see the real second round. And instead, I flew into, you know, streets on fire, and no one knows what's going to happen the next day. So I woke up the next day after getting to Tehran. This had been my fourth time to Tehran at that point. And I said, okay, I'm just going to go to a protest and see what happens. And I ended up in a crowd of, 250,000 people. And, I had taught a class on social movements, a graduate class, and I really was very, very structuralist in my instruction, in my teaching of class before my experience here. I said, I was very into sort of theories of, long-durée transformation and elites, sort of elite state-centered theory of social movements, which was the prevailing theory. And I saw these sort of all these micro-mobilizations all around me, the different ways in which people got other people to get out on the street. And that was a huge experience for me intellectually, to see, you have to have your eyes open for it, right? But to see how mobilization actually works, especially in a situation of radical uncertainty. This isn't like a social movement where let's all meet on the Washington Mall, on October 1st, and let's talk about the environment. And let's make sure that we rent the stage and we get the celebrities and we make sure we hire the banjo band. No, this is it was a radical uncertainty. You had no idea the next day, was there going to be anybody when you showed up? Was there going to be a guy with a gun? Was there going to be, a pile? You had no idea. And that, in that sense, it was very much like 1979. Because if you read the way that people actually experienced 79, not after the fact, but the day-to-day, it was a situation of radical uncertainty. And this goes back to the fundamental problem of explaining social movements. The free rider problem, that if there's a crowd of a million protesting for something, even if you agree with them, why be the million and one? They're already doing it. But if everybody believed that, then you wouldn't get social movements at all. So on the one hand, it doesn't make sense from the a micro theory of rational choice mobilization. So some of the recent work on sort of micro mobilizations of social movements, I borrowed and adapted for the article I eventually wrote about 2009, that there was this process which was both highly emotional as well as very micro situated, in which mobilization occurs. And social movement theory is a body of work which names more than explains. It just creates new terms for everything. So I came up with a term called brokered exuberance, that there's sort of this exuberance which pulls people in, but there has to be particular brokers, individual brokers, who do that. And it's not just anybody can be mobilized or anybody can do the mobilizing. So that was the experience that I had in that. Did I feel in danger? Well, everybody felt like it was in danger in that sense. I certainly didn't tell anybody I was going to the protests. In that sense, I was doing my sort of Clark Kent work during the year as the guy studying welfare systems. And then I was also, I don't want to be Superman. I was Peter Parker, Spider-Man. I was Peter Parker, and then I was doing a little bit of Spider-Man stuff, going to protest. But in that sense, it changed the way I saw Iran. But it also, since I was there for that experience and talk to people who had been involved and look, who are these people? Who were their parents? Who were their grandparents? I realized that, you know, this wasn't this opposition that always exists, this so-called civil society in Iran, which just exists and has no link to the state. It hates the state. It just, and it's ready to break out and make this, you know, pure form, Western-friendly, democratic, secular state. That's totally crazy. And I saw, once you see it at the ground level, you realize the deep, deep link between social movements in Iran, both the ones that we see and the ones that we don't, as well as various attempts by the state to sort of reach down in society, transform it in all kinds of ways, not just the ways that we have recognized and we think are either backwards or forwards, et cetera, but all kinds of other ways, including social policy and welfare. So in that sense, it was an experience which informed my, you know, my project and really made it coherent.
One of the things you just mentioned here is brokered exuberance, and this is occurring right around the time of the 2009 election. You're there 2 days after the election, the first round election results broke. You also mentioned something about electoral exuberance, and so are the brokers of this exuberance somehow connected with the parties of the election?
Well, this is the problem with Iranian politics is that they don't have parties. Okay, so they have as mentioned, a bunch of individuals running as larger things. There have been factions, there have been associations, but actually there's a fluidity in political demarcation in the Iranian elite, which allows them, one, to change their positions on everything all the time, but two, it creates, again, this bit of uncertainty about who supports who and how elections will play out. In that sense, it's been a problem. Why didn't, for example, the 1990s, which had again a bunch of social movements in Iran, the student movements, women's movements, why did those movements fail to push Iran in a democratic direction that could not be stopped? Arguably, the gains made in the 90s and early 2000s were not wholly reversed, but were stymied in the last 10 years. So why did that happen? Well, I mean, that's where people, of course, in the West tend to get down on parties these days, and party politics, and partisanism is a dirty word. But if you see a situation in which political elites, even when they want to, cannot act as transmission belts between social demands, social forces, new social forces, so the political negotiation at the top, you see where parties matter, however you want to call them or what did they want to look like. But Iran doesn't have them today, and they need them. They definitely need them. And, in fact, I wrote an article for Foreign Affairs the beginning of this year where one of my main, it's not like I can tell Iran what to do. I don't assume to do that. But one of the things that I think would help President Rouhani consolidate some of the gains that he's made and that sort of center left have made over the last year is to really help the institutionalization of party politics, because the 2009 election, nobody knew which way it was going to go. There's no way of gauging support. Polls are all over the place. In that sense, it presents a time of radical uncertainty, but also huge high expectations. I mean, politics in Iran continually produces participation rates in elections which blow out, Europe and the United States. I mean, they were talking about 70-80%. Even for the, parliament, it's something like 60%. Okay, so the 2009 election, depending on who you believe, was something like 80-85% participation, which is just unheard of. In 2013, it was 73%. So either way, this kind of political system run produces very rapid sort of bouts of mobilization in run-up to elections where, I was in Iran in 2013 for the election of Rouhani. 1 week before the election, everybody said they're not going to vote. And then come election day, everybody's getting out their national ID card to go vote. So that's a process that's actually very fascinating for sociologists, and I think that we still don't have a good grasp on it.
Give us some ideas of why you think the 2009 revolution, or green movement, I should say, never really took hold. It dissipated relatively quickly. You've already given us some ideas about this, but I mean, was it just exuberance without an organization? There are no party organizations to move this thing forward. The brokers are rather temporal. Or was there something also that the regime did that, you know, for instance, you know, jailed a couple key people in these movements and everybody else says, I don't want that, and they go home. So why didn't the 2009 Green Revolution become a revolution and we only call it a movement now?
Right. I mean, the first thing to think about is what were the demands, the main demands of the protests which took place right after the election. They weren't for the overthrow of the state, generally. They were for the rectification of this election, which people perceived as fraudulent. And in that sense, it probably can't be called a revolutionary movement at all. Now, the movement, in terms of just size of protests, as I try to argue, and most people don't realize, peaked incredibly early. It peaked within the first week of protests, so the sort of, you know, this mid-June protest all around Iran, when it was relatively safe to go out in the streets, which, you know, even the police didn't know what to do. And, you know, just, you know, everyone was totally unexpected. So, you know, people were taking advantage of this situation. That was the first week only. And then arguably, if just by size of the movement, you know, size of protests, it began to enter a demobilization phase. Now, some of this is tautological, right? That, you know, when a movement's winning, it's mobilizing, and when a movement's losing, it's demobilizing. However, I had to find out some way to think about, okay, well, where was the peak? And at least, you know, some people started joining, but a lot of people stopped. Now, as the movement shrank in size, some of it went online, but I think probably less so than we tend to say. It produced, like what most movements do when they're in decline, it produced radicalization of the hardcore members of the movement, and it produced a bunch of people who said, actually, I was never part of it at all. Think about the early 70s and what happened to the New Left. So in that sense, you got actually a radicalization of the protesters themselves, who remained and continued to protest, both in terms of tactics. They were totally, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails at the cops, as well as saying, you know, we want the overthrow of the state, down with this dictator, down this, that. So the question, I guess, for the researcher is how to relate that to the movement as a whole. If the movement would have continued to, let's say, grow, would it really have produced a revolution, or would it have produced, you know, a different kind of thing? However, it didn't, and I'm of the opinion that, given that I saw a lot of the movement happen, that it's not just, the explanation is not just that the state became repressive and that went and killed people or arrested people. You know, we have this problem in the social movement theory that the relationship between repression and mobilization is very undetermined. And sometimes, you know, states repress and movements get bigger. Take a look at Egypt, 2011. 18 days, they overthrew Mubarak. That was a repressive crackdown, and it produced a revolution. In other cases, repression produces demobilization. So we actually can't explain the failure of the Green Movement to, you know, achieve whatever goals they had, even a small amount of them, by just saying, well, that the state is repressive and that's what happened. I think the organizational issue is key here. And, of course, on the one hand, I said that, you know, the 1979 revolution didn't have organizations, didn't have this. But, you know, the forces aligned with Mir Hossein Mousavi and the sort of institutions and organizations, at least, that backed him, although they weren't big political parties, like I mentioned, there were people who had been sort of, you know, been around a long time. And all those guys, basically all the second bananas of Mousavi and this sort of coalition of political elite that had tried to get him elected and had pushed for him and took part in this pre-electoral mobilization process were put in jail. And I think that happened the day after the election. I mean, it really happened very, very fast. So within 1 to 2 days, all the key political actors, which could have created a link between this spillover mobilization which was totally out of the hands of Mousavi. I mean, he wasn't running any of this stuff, by the way. They could have that coordination could have already produced something that actually would have forced the state to respond and maybe give in. You know, who knows? But instead, they arrested the right guys, I would imagine, because it immediately severed any kind of link between political elites and this mobilization from below. The irony is that the biggest mobilization since '79 came after this severing. So it was organization free, and that was in a way its strength, that people could just go and start a protest and never people would show up. But that was its true weakness. I mean, its real reason that the demobilization set in is that there was no organizational backing, and there were no organizations that came out of it. Not at all. There's no underground. I mean, when I came back to the U.S. about a year later, people were always asking about the green underground. I said, there's no underground. You know, people essentially went into political apathy. It looks like post-68 in Czechoslovakia, for example. People were getting into other things, but not politics. And that's why 2013 was so surprising, that here was this 4 years where people who had put their lives on the line, maybe done a bit of jail time, they were all of a sudden mobilized again to take part. And not only mobilized again, they were mobilizing. A lot of the election in 2013, which we don't realize because the story has really not been told yet, is that the networks that were created, not institutionalized, but were created in 2009, which then dissipated, they were reactivated in 2013 to get people to vote, which sounds pretty crazy, right? 2009 was supposed to be elections are fraudulent. But given what's happened in Iran in the last 4 years and the dire state of things, and that there's no really option other than to just change the leadership a bit and see what happens, that a lot of people who took part in 2009 took part again in 2013, and they were arguably not the only, but a catalyst in this, again, unexpected mobilization, but through electoral institutions, which produced the surprising win of Hassan Rouhani in the first round. And we all know, just in the last year, what has been the result of that election. It's probably going to be the most important election in post-revolutionary history in Iran.
I am going to let that linger a little bit. You wrote a very interesting piece that you mentioned earlier in Foreign Affairs about advice for Rouhani, and I'm going to point our listeners back to that, but we have a little bit of time here, and one of the things that fascinates me about your research is that you're not only looking at this very interesting and important country in the world, Iran, but you're really rethinking and remaking the idea of how we understand social movements, and watching your research and your writings progress is going to be something that I think a lot of scholars should be doing. So it's really fascinating. And so I want to take this in a slightly different direction, move it away from Iran a little bit, and have you speculate. Now, I know that speculation is always dangerous for social scientists, but danger is our middle name here on Research on Religion. So what are your thoughts, given all that you've seen in Iran and have thought about the future of Iran and the Middle Eastern region in general, and perhaps even the so-called Arab Spring, in light of all this, your understanding of social movements at the grassroots, where are things heading? And go ahead, speculate.
Right. One thing that at least comes out of research and not just armchair speculation is that this long-term process of state formation and in tandem the formation of social movements with a particular, as Chuck Tilley used to call it, repertoire of contention. This process continued after the revolution, but drew upon a much longer process of sort of, as we say, state social formation. And that is not a linear process by any means, which Chuck Tilley also used to point out. In countries, it can go backwards and forwards. When the state collapses, you see a very different type of social movement emerge. Civil wars, for example, come in weak states. They don't come in strong states. So in Iran, actually, the civilizing process of political contention is rather impressive after the revolution and the war. That you really have a mobilized if you want to call it that, civil society in Iran, which, you know, the state is, even if it pretends it's not paying attention to it, it is. And, of course, it's not one thing in and of itself. I don't generally like the term civil society as an actor. It might describe other things. So that process is something which other parts of the Middle East do not have. And with all the problems of Iran, you know, I'm the first one to talk about all the problems going on there and the challenges. That's one thing it has, which in that sense, that's why, ironically, it is a stable place in the Middle East in a time in which states are collapsing or being severed all around the region. And, you know, you can't compare Iran, which unfortunately is done all the time, you can't compare Iran to, you know, a city-state like Dubai or Qatar. You know, these are city-states. And people often say, well, Iran's no Dubai. I said, yeah, well, you know, Dubai's a city. It's like comparing, you know, China to Hong Kong. It doesn't really work. So this is why we end up in this very odd position that, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, where here it is, it's June 2014, and... you know, the neighbors of Iran are do not have, let alone political stability, don't have these sort of states as such, which can reach down in society, which have control over territory, you know, the basic definitions of states. And in that sense, Iran, you know, probably by accident, but by hook or crook, has become a weird bedfellow for maybe the United States. In what, you know, what will happen in the Middle East in the future. So, you know, everybody I know, no one I know says that the Arab Spring was bad or that they wish it didn't happen. These were states that had social contracts which were essentially ossified. Mm-hmm. From Syria to Egypt, you know, to the other Maghreb states. So, you know, these movements that pushed back against the state in all these different places, I went to Egypt in 2010, so 1 year before the Egyptian revolution, not-so-revolution. And I just came out of Iran, 2009, with the Green Movement. And, you know, Egyptians were telling me, oh, you're so lucky in Iran. I'm like, why are we lucky in Iran? You know, they're like, because you have hope. And we don't have hope here. I said, well, why don't you have hope? Because nothing changes in Egypt. Everything changes in Iran. It might change for the worse, but you know that there's going to be change. And, of course, then in Egypt they had this amazing, you know, revolution, but then, of course, the not-so-amazing denouement. But one thing I do know about Egypt now that maybe I didn't know and others didn't know at the time is that this is not a stable situation. In Egypt, for example, mm-hmm. And it's certainly not stable in the rest of the Middle East. So we know the change is in the air, right? I mean, I don't want to say that's a platitude, but we do know that change is basically built into the region now. And that's one thing we did not believe for 30 years. For 30 years, the scholarship of the Middle East was about explaining stasis, about explaining the lack of change, the lack of so-called transition. Why no so-called transition in the Middle East? I think those are basically what the Arab Spring showed us, was that those were the wrong questions to ask. And so if it has done anything, it's forced scholars to go back and look at the questions they were asking and say, maybe we were asking the wrong questions the whole time. And in that sense, I think I'm very hopeful for at least scholarship on the Middle East, but I'm actually hopeful for the Middle East more generally, although right now it seems rather dire. Again, these kind of, you know, rapid movements of revolution, counter-revolution, waves of protests, which are not only common in history but common in the Middle East. We think about 70, 80 years ago, same thing was happening. We know that what comes out of it doesn't look like what came before it.
Well, we are going to have to continually watch for all of that, and it's been fascinating talking with you. I have one more question kind of to check the validity of your projections. We always, in social science, have to, you know, take some alternative measures to see how valid and reliable the measures are. The final question I have for you to see how good you are at predicting the future is, who's going to win the World Cup?
Right. Well, I can predict it's not going to be Iran, although they had an impressive tie against Nigeria. And this, I just see the Dutch just won again. So in that sense, in sports, I'm a bandwagon predictor. In social science, I'm a contrarian. Mm. So I'm not going to say Brazil, but since the Dutch seem to be playing super football, I'm going to go with the Dutch.
Well, we'll see how that is, and we'll see how contrarian your other projections are. Kevin, it has been a delight having you on Research on Religion. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.